Hey, Tacoma, John Doherty here once again for Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, sometimes optimistically, but really our goal is to take a clear-eyed look at what the reality of our climate and the contributions of fossil fuels, other things to our ever-warming planet, and most of all, what we can do about it. Part of that clear-eyed look is going to be coming from my conversation today with Dr. James Konka. He's a scientist with over 30 years of experience with energy, the distribution of energy, the production of energy, both in the Pacific Northwest, nationally, and around the world. Dr. Konka has a lot to say, all of it worthwhile in my view. Because of the length of our conversation, I've divided into two parts. Today we're going to be talking about asking the question, answering the question, does the Pacific Northwest have enough green energy? By that I mean hydro, wind, and solar to provide 100% of our electrical needs. And the second half, we'll be taking an equally clear-eyed look at what role, if any, nuclear fuel can play in our energy environment here in the Pacific Northwest and around the world as far as that goes. So here we go. Let's listen in on my conversation with Dr. James Konka. John Doherty here with Dr. James Konka. I'll call him Jim if that's all right. Is that all right with you?
Yes, indeed.
Okay,
good
great.
Good to be here. So,
yeah, well, we're thrilled to have you, and I'll explain more about that here in a second. Just briefly, Dr. Konka, well, the way I first learned about Dr. Konka was reading Forbes magazine and some of his contributions as a science contributor there. Intriguing stuff. And there's nothing like having a little reality in my thinking. And I appreciated the articles for that. He's got a long resume, including years at Washington State University, New Mexico State, Los Alamos. He's been an advisor to the Department of Energy and the EPA. He was involved with the Yucca Mountain Project for 25 years. I'm going to ask a little later on what's going on with the Yucca Mountain Project. He has a PhD in geochemistry from California Institute of Technology. I think that's what we typically call Caltech. And pretty amazing place technologically, one of the premier technological institutes in the world. I can remember being in high school myself and having an interest in math and science and taking a look at Caltech and saying, I'm not going to get in there. So he's got a master's in planetary science from Brown.
Also from Caltech. Yeah.
Oh, also from Caltech. Okay, a little confused there on my part. And a bachelor's from Brown University. So a pretty amazing resume and a guy who speaks with authority. So, Jim, the way I'm seeing the conversation today, I want to talk in from two different perspectives. Number one, ask the question, can green energy, and by that I mean wind, solar, and hydro, can that provide, I guess, A, the United States' demand or needs for electric energy, and then possibly take a peek at what that would mean for the world? And then the second thing is, clearly you have an exceedingly strong background in nuclear energy, and I'm going to ask the question, you know, can we safely have nuclear energy for a baseline electricity source? So that's the big picture what we're looking at. So and everything we're talking about here is within the framework of this impending disaster that we're looking at, the fossil fuel emissions and the ever-warming, ever-changing climate. So for starters, let me just ask you the big question then, Jim. Let's talk about the Pacific Northwest, at least at first, in terms of can these clean energy sources alone provide us with the electricity we need going into the future?
The short answer is no, because right now the Pacific Northwest is generally powered by hydroelectric with a little bit of nuclear and a little bit of wind, and then the surrounding states with you know, a significant amount of coal. But the problem is, hydro is great. I mean, it really is amazing, and we have so much of it here. The rest of the country and the rest of the world don't have that much. So hydro is limited physiographically in terms of, you know, you need rivers, you need elevation changes, you know, you need, you know, it has to be correct. You just can't throw it up anywhere. And so that's great here. The problem also with hydro is that it does so many things. Okay, it doesn't just produce power. All right, it's you know, it controls floods, it controls irrigation, it fish migration, navigation, water supply. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff it does besides producing power, and that's why when we get into talk about capacity factors, that's why the capacity factor or the percent of time that hydro is producing what it's supposed to is only about 40%. And that's because it does all this other stuff. You just can't focus on one thing as far as rivers go. So
Excuse me, just a second, Jim. Let me ask, would you just branch off here for a second and talk about what you mean by capacity factor?
Excellent, because that's the problem. It's one of these things that sounds simple, but it is not simple at all. Capacity factor is the annual average percent of the maximum output possible. Okay. So it's pretty much the percentage of the time it's producing what it says it is. Now, when you install a generation system, whether it's a natural gas plant or a wind farm or a solar farm, it has what's called a nameplate capacity. So you have installed like 1 gigawatt. Okay. Now, units are funny. I hate them, but people hate them, but you know, a watt is simply a measure of power. Now, if you want to know how much power you're producing over time, you need to have it in watt hours or kilowatt hours, which is my favorite unit because that's what comes at the end of the month in everyone's bill. You pay for kilowatt hours. And in Washington State, we pay 8 cents a kilowatt hour, which is the cheapest in the country because of hydro. And because we are a regulated market, which I mean, I'm a regulatory hound. Deregulation is a horrible thing. It just means someone makes a lot of money off of us. So capacity factor, say you put in a 1 gigawatt wind farm. Okay. Now, because the wind doesn't blow all the time and it doesn't blow at the right speed all the time, it has to be between 35 and 40 miles an hour to be really efficient. So then the wind only produces that 1 gigawatt 34% of the time on average in America. In Washington, it's actually a lot less than that. So it's only producing it about a third of the time. Now, a coal plant produces it on average about 50% of the time, which isn't, you know, that great, but you can determine when it happens. A nuclear plant produces power 93% of the time. The power it's supposed to. So it has the highest capacity factor. It's always had the highest capacity factor of anything because it's not dependent on anything. It's not dependent on the weather, like wind or solar. It's not dependent on fueling because it takes so little fuel to power a nuclear reactor. You only have to change fuel, you know, once every 2 years, whereas coal, you have to shovel in 10,000 tons of coal every day. So, I mean, it takes a lot of coal. So, you know, the same thing with gas. In terms of capacity factor, if you install equal amounts of installed capacity, say nuclear and wind, okay, say you do a 1,000 megawatt reactor like we have out here near where I'm sitting in Richland, Washington, or whether you put in a wind farm like occurs in California and in some parts of Washington State, you've put in the same amount of installed power, 1,000 megawatts. Now, for nuclear, that's 1,000 megawatts times 93% times 8,766 hours per year. So what that nuclear plant produces is 8 million megawatt hours a year, or 8 billion kilowatt hours a year. Now, the wind farm, same install capacity, only produces it 27% of the time in Washington State. Times 8,766 hours per year, it only produces 2 million megawatts or 2 billion kilowatt hours per year. So it's a quarter. It produces a quarter of the amount of power. And the thing is, you can't determine when that is. It's simply whenever the wind's blowing. So if it blows when you don't need it, you lose it, basically. Or, you know, whereas nuclear, you can, if you need to stop it, you stop it. If you need to start it, you start it. So you have what's known as intermittent sources, which is wind and solar, where you do, and even hydro to a certain extent, where you can't plan on it. Okay, now hydro is okay unless you have a drought or something happens and you need that water for something else, but you generally can depend on it. Wind, you know, it simply blows when it blows, and solar, you know, only when the sun's out and there's not a lot of cloud cover and all that kind of thing. So your intermittent sources, wind and solar, you have to back up with something. And usually you back it up with natural gas in America. In Pacific Northwest, we back it up with hydropower. So when wind is blowing hard and you're producing a lot of power and it's going onto the grid and the wind stops blowing, someone has to be sitting at a computer screen and flip something on. I mean, if the grid has to be balanced. I'm sorry, I'm kind of going off here on tangents, but the grid has to be balanced. You have to produce power, deliver it, and use it all in the same second. Okay, you have to balance it. If you produce more than you consume, you start blowing transformers and melting things. If you consume more than you produce, you start having blackouts. So it has to be balanced. And we've never had a problem with that because most of our energy has been what we know as baseline, which means it just runs whenever you want it to run. So it's been, you know, gas, coal, nuclear, and some hydro. So you can depend on those when you need them. So if something happens, you just kind of flip on a natural gas plant or, you know, divert water into the turbines as opposed to spilling it over the top of the dam. So you have control. With wind and solar, you don't have control. And that's the big problem. They don't work very often, and you have no control over when they work. So as a result, you have to install 3 to 4 to 5 times the power you think you need. So when you have a 1,000 megawatt nuclear, you have to put in 4,000 or 5,000 megawatts of wind to equal that. And even then, you still don't have control over when that comes. So you need something to back it up. And again, in the Pacific Northwest, we use hydro. In California, you use gas. In some parts of the world, you use coal. Germany's new coal plants, they're backing up all their wind farms. So they, you know, when the wind stops blowing, they fire up the new coal plants they have. So you need something. Now, everyone thinks about batteries and that, you know, storage, and that's wonderful. We will get there sometime in the next 100 years. We will have batteries to that extent, but nowhere near in the next 20 or 30. We just don't have the lithium. We don't have the vanadium. We don't have the cobalt. We just don't have the critical minerals to produce that much battery power. And battery power doesn't last. It fades over time. So you have to use it. Sometimes when the wind stops blowing for 3 weeks, you're going to have problems if you don't have something else to back that up. So it's a complex system. It's not simple. Everyone goes, yeah, green, wonderful, that's great. And I agree, that's great. But you have to understand the grid and how it works in order to be ready. Now, one of the weird things about... Yeah, go ahead.
I just like to sum up from my own layperson perspective here for a second. So it's kind of like what I see as the big picture. So the big picture is wind and solar are intermittent. There's nothing we can do about that. We can't make the wind blow. And even if we install lots of wind, I mean, if that just means you've got lots of wind turbines that are not turning around instead of just a few wind turbines that are turning around. And of course, hydro does have some aspect of intermittency. I think they've certainly seen that done in California with, even behind Hoover Dam, there's some question about whether those turbines are going to be turning here in the next decade or so. So we have this intermittent power source. Yeah, it is clean, and that's, yay clean, but we're facing the possibility, I believe I'm inferring this from what you've been saying, we're facing the possibility if we just rely on wind, solar, and hydro, that there will be times when the demand is not met with those sources, and we're going to have rolling blackouts or brownouts or whatever. So is that a fair summary of what you're saying, Jim?
Absolutely. In fact, we almost had a bunch of rolling blackouts this summer during the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, Bonneville Power Administration was very worried, and they put out a statement saying we barely averted rolling blackouts in June because we had so much hydro. So when people talk about decommissioning hydro dams, I cringe because we would have had it. You know, without one of those Snake River dams, we would have had rolling blackouts in June. There's no question about it. Now, And we still have our coal plants. Okay. Now, what's happening is that, you know, the Clean Energy Transformation Act, CETA, okay, which is a wonderful piece of legislation. It's great. We're going to get rid of coal by 2025. Okay. But the problem is we're not planning to replace it with anything. We hope we can buy energy from, you know, imported from other states or from Canada. Well, that, you know, they're going through the same issues. So everyone thinks, you know, if things get really bad, you can just import energy. And that's fine now, but it will not be fine in 10 years because it won't be enough energy to import as we start closing all the fossil fuel plants.
So let me ask a quick question here. So I'm talking to you from Tacoma. And of course, in Tacoma, we're powered by TPU, and TPU's electricity is almost 100% hydro. So when you talked about possible rolling blackouts last summer and BPA's concerns, would that have affected us here in Tacoma?
Yes, because you're connected to the grid. Okay, so when you are connected to the same grid, it's all the same. Okay, you no one can tell where the electrons come from. So I really love it when someone says we're 100% renewable energy now, like you know Apple or something says, oh, this is this facility is 100% renewable. They have no clue what it is because you can't track the electrons on the grid. Whatever goes on goes on. Now you might think, you might say I'm going to pay extra for renewable energy in order to help the grid become more renewable. But it's not that the renewable energy electrons are going to you. You have no clue. Okay. So if there were rolling blackouts coming and BPA had to decide, and this is one of the issues, they have to decide what to black out, who to black out. Okay. And they decide, okay, Tacoma can go black for 5 hours. Sure. Fine. Okay. It has nothing to do with the fact that you're all hydro. It's the fact that the grid does not have enough power coming to it as the consumption goes up. So the real problem is during bad weather. During fine weather, everything's great. But when it's really cold or really hot, wind and solar do not work. That's one of the big issues, especially wind. Does not work when it's really cold or really hot. So what happened in June, in that heat wave that we had, was that the 7,000 megawatts of wind we have in Washington State was only producing 500 megawatts. 7,000 megawatts of wind was only producing 500. Losing the equivalent of 7 coal plants overnight. And there was almost nothing to do except hydro save the day. Okay. And of course, the nuclear plant here was chugging out like crazy. So, that's fine. We were lucky. But that's when we still had a lot of coal. 2025, coal is going to go away. Okay. So, the Centralia, the final unit of the Centralia coal plant will be shut down in 2025. And there's a whole bunch of other coal plants around the Pacific Northwest that are shutting too. So when that happens, suddenly you don't have any coal. And the Northwest Power Pool, which is a collection of utilities and generators and suppliers and operators, they right now we have about a 5% chance of a rolling blackout, and that's not bad. Okay, so just a 5% chance. It's been that way for 40 years because we've had plenty of power, and our population hasn't grown that much. Unfortunately, our population is growing now. And industry is growing, and electric vehicles use is growing. And so we're going to close Centralia coal plant. So in 2025 or 2026, after it's closed, the Northwest Power Pool says we're going to have a 26% chance of rolling blackouts constant. That's 1 in 4. That is insane. That's when you start having real rolling blackouts. And of course, if it's really hot, some people die. If it's really cold, some people die. And of course, some people might think, well, that's just the cost of doing business. That's not good. Okay. You cannot have a 26% chance of rolling blackouts. That is not a grid that's where, you might expect that in Bangladesh. You might expect that in some parts of Africa, but not in America and not in the Pacific Northwest. It has never had a resource problem, never had an energy problem. And now we're going to face problems. So what's there?
I just want to get some clarification for myself here. So what I'm hearing you say, Jim, is on the track that we're on, and taking into consideration CETA, that unless we change something, we're going to, after 2026, we're going to have significant blackouts, rolling blackouts and brownouts. Is that right? I mean, it's like the dire kind of cast on that.
Yeah. When you start closing that much coal capacity, 6,000 gigawatts are going to be gone. I'm sorry, 6,000 megawatts are going to be gone by the end of, within 9 years. Not just the Centralia plant in Washington State, our last one, but the ones in, Colstrip, the last unit there, the ones in Oregon, the ones in Nevada, those are all considered the Pacific Northwest and in Idaho. And so, when they close and there's nothing to replace them, what do you do? At the same time, California's facing the same thing.
Yeah. The big picture question that I'm asking you here, is there any scenario where it's possible that here in the Northwest that our electricity needs can be met with purely hydro, wind and solar? And one of the things I'm wondering about is, okay, I've heard you refer to the Midwest as Tornado Alley because there's lots of wind there. We've got the possibility of offshore wind where there's usually wind offshore. So is there any conceivable possibility that we can provide the electricity we need here in the Northwest by shipping it in from the Midwest wind energy, offshore wind and so on?
Probably not, because you always have a time, you know, a proportion of the time, whether it's, you know, a month, a year, or several weeks, a year, that even in the entire Northwest, the wind is not blowing. See, this is one of the problems. Now, Tornado Alley, like you mentioned, yeah, capacity factor for wind at Tornado Alley is 45-50%. I mean, you get twice as much power there as you do Washington State from the same amount of wind. So when you're building wind, you should build it all in Tornado Alley, since this takes, you know, 10 times the amount of steel per megawatt to put in wind as to put in anything else. And so, but you have to get that energy to where it's needed. So you're going to have to put in long distances, thousands of miles of high voltage transmission lines. And that's okay, except that's another thing that people don't like. So every time, it's just rather amazing. And this is why education is so important, understanding these things. If you have so much wind and solar, in fact, just 20% of your grid is wind and solar, you need to have a huge amount of transmission lines, or you can't get it there. And every time, you know, people in California, people in other places, Texas, you know, vote in wind, they vote down high voltage transmission line. Okay. Now that, I mean, that's shooting yourself in the foot. You can't do that. And so when I was in New Mexico 10 years ago, we put in a huge solar array, in the middle of the desert, perfect for it. And then the public voted down transmission lines to get it to Albuquerque. It's like, well, what good is it then? I mean, you know, so. You need everything. You need to understand the whole system, the grid entirely, in order to plan for the future. Now, in the past, we have planned very well. It's called a resource adequacy plan. And in fact, before CETA, the coal, you know, the Centralia coal plant was going to be replaced by two gas plants. All right. And now that's not going to happen. Now, it's not that CETA prevents gas. It just discourages it greatly. Okay. And then, of course, everyone says, well, we'll get carbon capture. Yeah, we'll get carbon capture at some point in the distant future, to the point where we need it, but we're not going to have it anytime soon. To take care of, you know, thousands of megawatts of power. So again, everyone rely, you know, we become this weird, I call it the Apollo effect. Everyone thinks we can just, you know, technology our way out of problems. It's like, yeah, there are some things technology is good for, but there are some things it's not. And certainly the technology you've developed over the last 100 years, just think you're going to replace it in the next 10 with something that looks good on paper, but doesn't work in the reality. Then you're just asking for trouble.
What kind of shape is our grid in? I mean, you've alluded to the fact that it's kind of out there, but people don't want to really pay any attention to it. And it seems like it's critical for our energy system. So what kind of shape nationally is the grid in? And I'm looking downstream as more demand for electricity, right, for electric vehicles, for instance.
Well, this gets back to the infrastructure issue. Okay. I people don't like the word infrastructure. They don't really know what it means, but it means just this exact thing, the grid, bridges, roads, everything. So the American Society of Civil Engineers every year gives a report card on America for everything. For bridges, for rail, for energy. And energy got a C. Okay, now that's not failing. Now, 2 years ago, it was a D. Okay, so it was failing. But that's okay. It's a little bit better now. Nothing got an A, by the way. There's no infrastructure in America that got an A. All right, not even the internet. So the best one was rail. It got a B, which surprised the heck out of me. We got a C. Now, that means that our transformers are old, you know, the big transformers, the huge ones, even the little ones you can see on top of poles are old, and they keep blowing, and they keep blowing at a rate that's increasing. So the big transformers that cost, you know, $400 million, I kid you not, $4 million, take 7 years to make, okay? Those keep blowing at a record rate because they're old. And when you don't have those huge transformers, you're in big trouble. That's a blowing of one of those transformers is what causes blackouts in the Midwest and stuff like that. There was a huge blackout several years ago because a transformer blew, one of the big ones. So we don't make them often enough. We don't have any in spare. And so, you know, we're just teetering. We're just asking for trouble. Put it that way. So, you know, if you have a grade of C on your grid, that's okay. It's a passing grade. But it's not someone like, you know, someone who had straight C's on their report card. You don't want to really hire them for a job because you really can't depend on them to handle the tough stuff. And that's what we're asking our grid to do now, is to handle tough stuff and getting more and more tough. And it's going to fail at some point, as it does, as it did this, you know, this year for California and Texas.
So my guess is, and you can correct me on this if necessary, that C is a snapshot right now. I mean, is that evaluation look downstream 5-10 years? I mean, if it's a C right now, that's one thing. Is it, what's it going to be in 2030?
Ah, well, this is where politics comes into it. If we pass that infrastructure bill, then we'll be in better shape. If we don't, we will be in terrible shape. So, I mean, that's just the way it is. No, I mean, it's like a bridge. You see a bridge where the cement's cracking. Yeah, you can keep driving over for some amount of time if you want to risk. And then at some point, it's going to fall. And hopefully, you won't be on the bridge when that happens. But that's not a plan.
Yep. Well, so one of the things that I think that we're experiencing here as a species is we're in kind of a pinchers. On the one hand, we've got the looming threat of climate change. And on the other hand, we've got a world that wants lots of cheap energy. And it's hard for me to see how we're going to get out of this one. So I guess I'll just ask you, how are we going to get out of this one?
Aha. Let me get philosophical here for a bit. The backdrop to all of these discussions and all other, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, climate change, and all other environmental insults is a millennial-old dynamic tension between giving humans a good life and protecting the environment. That's the dynamic tension. Now, in America, we kind of forget the fact that there are a lot of people, over a billion, that still don't have access to energy. Okay, so we kind of forget that. And we don't even, you know, we're not sure we even care about that much, except, you know, mentally. But if, you know, but that's what it is. It takes about 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year to lift someone up out of poverty. Now, think about that. 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year to lift someone out of poverty. Now, if we are going to 10 billion people here soon, which we are, and it takes 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year to lift someone up out of poverty, that means we need at least 30 trillion kilowatt hours of electricity just to eradicate global poverty. And that's only if we spread the, you know, the wealth well, which we don't do. So it's going to probably take about 40 trillion. Right now, we're at 24. So we are growing. So when, you know, the numbers are big, they mean something. You've got to actually know these numbers. So when people talk about replacing energy, they never talk about this growth. I mean, there is continuous growth. And so now you're not just trying to install green energy to replace existing dirty energy. You're talking about replacing green energy to deal with this growth of all energy. And we don't have that. In fact, I, you know, you want to throw out to your listeners, what's the fastest growing energy sources in the world? You know, I tell that to classes. I, you know, show of hands, what's the fastest growing energy source in the world? Do you have an idea?
Well, I'm going to guess it's coal.
Close. That's number two.
Okay, so oil. It would be natural gas then.
Oil.
Okay.
Right. So it's oil, coal, and natural gas are the three fastest growing energy sources in the world for the actual amount of energy. I don't mean percentage wise. I don't care about percent wise. I don't care if something's growing 10% a year. 10% of zero is still zero. So, you know, renewables are coming up. That's great. They're not coming up anywhere near fast enough to even keep pace with the growth of fossil fuel, let alone replace it. And that's why I get upset when people talk about they don't want hydro or they don't want nuclear. It's like, wait a second, you don't have a luxury of choice here. Okay, you have fossil fuel and you have everything else. And everything else has to come up as fast as it possibly can in order to even make a dent in fossil fuel use, because it's rising so quickly.
So let me
this,
just...
You know, this is the problem.
Let me just drop something in real quick here. This is a little bit philosophical too. And that is, I see that in our culture, our economic system, that we've really become extremely accustomed to, we turn the switch, the light comes on, we plug something in, we start our stove, whatever. It's always there. And I think the idea can develop over time. Yeah. Well, that's just the way it is. You know, we got electricity and it's just right there and I can get it. And I don't think people adequately look at what the consequences are of intermittent electric supply. I mean, the country is going to be up in arms politically if, and our view as a species is relatively short term. So it's like, well, yeah, maybe there is a problem with the climate, but right now I need electricity to keep my family safe and warm. And so let's worry about the climate yep. later and get electricity now. So is that an
absolutely.
Accurate view of things?
And that's absolutely the problem. And that's what I mentioned. There's this dynamic tension between human life and the environment. And so, you know, we are, you know, when something gets really bad, you care about survival. And so, but this is one of these weird sociological, non-intuitive results. It turns out when someone gets out of poverty, when they get 3,000 kilowatt hours per year, they start to think differently, okay? They actually believe they will live to age 40 and that their children will live to age 40. And that's a huge deal if you're in a developing country where you the average age is not 40. And so it turns out throughout history, it doesn't matter whether it's a 17th century nobleman, which was getting the equivalent of 3,000 kilowatt hours off the backs of 10 slaves, 10 indentured servants, 4 oxen and 4 horses. It's a great calculation for the student. I always give them that. Or it's you and me just sitting here getting, you know, 10,000 kilowatt hours per year off the backs of hydro and a little bit of others. It doesn't matter. You need that. And so throughout history, access to energy has been the best birth control there has ever been. When you get I'm not kidding, it sounds funny. When you get to be 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year, the birth rate drops to below 2. You can just look throughout the world. The last 100 years has been obvious, but even you look in the distant past, it was the aristocracy always died out because they stopped having children. Because when you have a good life, you stop having children. I mean, that's just the way it is. Uh-huh. And so is this weird, you know, we have to deal with this, that people in poverty itself is the most destructive environmental process there is. Human poverty, the most destructive environmental process. If you're in a poor country, you use so much more land to grow the same amount of food as here. You cut down every tree you have in order to burn it because you're just burning wood manure as your main source of energy. So anyway, so when you think about that going forward in the future, there are over 1 billion people that have no access to energy. There's about 2 billion people that still burn wood manure as their main source of energy. And there's 3 billion more people going to be born. That is not a trivial amount of energy. That's almost the amount of energy we use now. And so if you think you're going to cut fossil fuel, well, then you better have everything else ramping up faster than you can imagine. And that includes nuclear. It includes wind, includes nuclear, includes hydro, includes everything except fossil fuel.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Dr. Konka as much as I'm enjoying it. We'll pick up next week with the second half of this interview. In the meantime, I want to sort of go over a few of the basic points that I learned today listening to Dr. Konka. Right now, 80% of our worldwide energy is coming from fossil fuels. Well, that's bad enough in itself, but the reality is that fossil fuel use is growing faster than green energy is. So green energy, yeah, it's growing. Wind and solar is growing, and we can be happy for that. But it's not even keeping up with the growth of worldwide demand for fossil fuels. So that's disturbing and does leave the question, well, how do we get caught up with fossil fuels and see that use of those fuels coming to an end sometime in our future? We can add to that a couple more really important considerations. Right now, we're adding 1 billion people to the planet every 12 years. So those folks are going to need energy. They're going to want energy. And then there's the poverty issue. The amount of poverty still existing in the world is big. We're talking at least 1 billion people living in abject poverty. And abject poverty is worse than you might imagine. It's talking about people who are living on maybe just a couple dollars a day. The worldwide international system of poverty is set at $5.50 a day. So we're talking over 1 billion people on the earth who make less than $5.50 a day. And folks, they want more. They want to have secure access to food and housing and healthcare and those kind of things. Many of the things that we tend to take for granted. So are those things all require energy. So we're looking at a very big demands for energy going into the future. And the reality is that we are not even keeping up with what's going on right now. So a huge problem, one that Dr. Konka is going to offer a nuclear power as a possible solution to that. And I know there are concerns about nuclear fuel. That's part of the clear-eyed view that I'm hoping that we can take with Dr. Konka in terms of safety, security, costs, licensing, terrorism, all of those kind of things. So be sure and tune in next week for the sequel to this excellent conversation. You can contact me anytime at John, J-O-H-N, at cctacoma.org. I am an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. You can check out Citizens Climate Lobby at cctacoma.org. It's a good outfit, good people. Check it out. You might find something there for you. So that's it for today. Here I am once again reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.